Thank you, Dr. Kimmerer. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum hosted by the Peterborough Unitarian Universalist Church, located in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We do have some time for questions from our audience. Let me begin by asking this. Traditional ecological knowledge is being recognized by the United Nations Environmental Program as having equal status with scientific knowledge and has been termed the intellectual twin to science. Are you satisfied with this definition? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
It's a great question. And this notion of the intellectual twin and equal status for indigenous science or traditional ecological knowledge has been a growing movement. In fact, if you were involved in the March for Science a few years ago, we actually made the statement, an indigenous people's science statement, that we need to be marching for sciences because there are multiple ways of knowing. And in many cases, I would say that traditional knowledge or indigenous science is a twin, in a sense, to science, because Western science, because it's deeply empirical. It grows from close observation of the living world. It regards the land as our teacher. So there's a lot of parallels. It has predictive power. It brings us technologies and adaptation. But one of the things that as a scientist, I have found very different to think about, when am I going to use indigenous knowledge and when am I going to use my Western scientific tools? Well, the answer is, as I always tell my students, it depends on the question. If the question are questions of true or false, the objective reality, if there is such a thing, of the world, Western scientific tools, very powerful, and we all use them in that regard. But the true-false questions aren't the only ones that we have out there. For those bigger questions of should we, traditional knowledge couples knowledge to responsibility and moral responsibility, whereas Western science is independent of that. And so I think it's always important to use them both together. It's not either or. For me, it is Western science and indigenous science working together on behalf of Mother Earth.
Thank you. These two questions actually touch a little bit about what we were talking about. I was referring to the emerald ash borer as sort of the Hell's Angels of of the insect world. The question is, how do you view invasive species? How and when would you choose to attempt controlling or eradicating the different invasive species? And this sort of prompted the next question is, do you perceive all plants equally? So what's our responsibility to restore the balance, which means killing off exotic plants, mm-hmm. plants that have moved in invasively?
Yeah. I like to preface a response to this question by saying that while I'm pulling garlic mustard in my beloved Trillium woods, I have a lot of time to think about this question and whether I should be doing that or not. This returns very much to this question of personhood, doesn't it? In the indigenous worldview, I didn't get a chance to talk about all of that today, but we view plants certainly as persons and as some of our very best teachers. And by viewing plants as persons and teachers, that gives you a rather different perspective than the knee-jerk reaction of many of my conservation biology colleagues, which is, if it's not native, get rid of it. Get out the herbicide, get out the machete. But there is this notion that if the plants are our teachers, should we first listen to them before trying to exterminate them? For example, around where I live, Phragmites is a big invading species in our wetlands. And you know, native people have some experience with invading species. And one of the things that we might ask about them, that Phragmites, is to say, well, why are they here? Why have you come? Because we have put so much nitrogen and phosphorus in the water that our native cattails and Sagittaria and so forth can't take it up. They can't, but Phragmites can. So perhaps before we embark on widespread eradication, we ought to say, what is the work? that you've come here to do. You know, what is your job here? There are lots of examples of how invasive species have, in some cases, settled in to be good naturalized citizens. So there are some good examples there. But there are also many of our beloved native ecosystems endangered by exotic species. So the importance is that we listen, we pay attention, we ask the question, and understand that the question is complex, rather than have this knee-jerk reaction. It is also true that within indigenous ways of knowing, when we ask ourselves, what is the role of human people? It is to take care of the rest of the living world, and equally, yes, even poison ivy. But human beings are balance makers. And so when I'm pulling garlic mustard, I'm not trying to eradicate that species. I actually say to that garlic mustard, you've got the ditches and the roadsides. It's all yours. Thrive. But not in my trillium woods. And so we create a balance. And so that would be my argument, is to let's think about this through the lens of what might these plants be bringing us in terms of ecological wisdom.
Thank you. Could you talk about research on the healing power of being in nature, specifically for senior citizens, although there are very few of those here tonight, who have less access many times to the natural world?
What a wonderful question. You're probably all familiar with, well, as human beings, of the healing powers of being in nature, no? The medical literature and the psychological literature as well is full of understanding that human beings, when we suffer from what was felicitously named nature deficit disorder, that physiologically and psychologically we suffer from disconnection from nature. And so there have been all kinds of new therapies, in a sense. I just was working with a group of folks who called themselves forest therapists to bring people back out into the world for the physiological and mental benefits of being in nature. A colleague of mine who works at a health service at a university writes prescriptions that read, you must go sit by the stream for an hour every day. And it does you more good than the prescription that pharmaceutical prescription that I might write for you. So we know these benefits well. And when we think about it, when our access to natural landscapes is limited, I think all we have to really do is travel there through breath. If you can't go out into the woods at all, remember that every breath you take in is plant breath. That's plant breath. And every breath that you exhale is for the animals. And so just the act of breathing and bringing yourself into that physical and spiritual relationship with the living world can be a way that in the most limited of natural exposures, you still remind yourself that you are a part of everything and that everything is a part of you.
Next question. What shall we do now?
Must be a good question.
What shall we do now, feel now, act upon now in the face of extinction? What is the role of women in this? I think we've got a couple of empowered people out here from your speech.
I love that question. Thank you. Thank you. There are so many answers to that question. I hope in part encapsulated in that notion to give your gift, whatever it is. Raise good children, raise a garden, raise a ruckus. That for me the most basic formulation has been that much of our approach to environmental problem solving and indeed to environmental activism has been fear-based. I think that an approach that women in particular, although certainly not exclusively, bring to this work is to motivate through love, to do our work on behalf of Mother Earth, that first woman, out of love. And the question that I ask myself every day and that I try to spread on the wind like dandelion seeds, in this time of climate change and the age of the sixth extinction, we are, as we know, going from an expansive time into the narrows. Our potential, the richness and diversity is narrowing. And so as every one of us pictures that narrowing, especially we elders, is to say, what do I love too much to lose? And you pick that up and you wrap it in your bundle, and the only way it's going to get to the future is if you carry it. What do I love too much to lose? Pick it up and carry it through.
Thank you again, Dr. Kimmerer, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Peterborough Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Monadnock Summer Lyceum lecture series, please visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org and stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. Our program next Sunday will feature minister and mother Kate Braestrup speaking about her new book, Anchor and Flares, Stories of Motherhood, Hope, and Service. Thank you again so much, Dr. Kimmerer, for your stimulating and wonderful presentation.